This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Noelle Lim. Offering classes in high-demand skills such as data science, General Assembly has been ranked by Fast Company as one of the most innovative education companies in the world. It could also be the most valuable education startup when it was sold to Adecco, the recruitment group, for $412 million. We welcome Ryan Mayer, Managing Director, Asia-Pacific of General Assembly, to the show. General Assembly offers shorter courses than universities and are focused on Industrial Revolution 4.0 type skills. Do you foresee GA might eventually replace the need to get a degree or master's, especially in the US where it costs a bomb to enter college?
When we set out to create General Assembly, we really focused on the connection between return on investment and education. So we're not in the business of necessarily going against the grain of the traditional education landscape. It's more about carving out a niche in that landscape. The way that it's best described, I think, is that we help people migrate from the old economy to the modern economy. And I think that's something that gets lost in the traditional education landscape, sometimes for good reasons. And you know, universities are built to last. They're not built to change quickly. And so, you know, when you go to a university, oftentimes it's a sign of strength if the university has been around for hundreds of years. But that doesn't mean that you should necessarily go there to study digital skills.
Perhaps you may get a foundation in universities either to learn how to think critically, but once you get out into the workforce and what you're trying to do is to close the gaps that emerge.
Exactly. And I think over the past 20 years, the acceleration of technology and the acceleration of society has caught everyone by surprise. So what's emerged is a skills gap. And by any measure in any geography around the world, there is a skills gap. There are modern economy skill sets that the government, that industry needs, and they can't find enough people. And so you have, you know, the most famous equation is if you look in Silicon Valley and you have, you know, your very highly paid engineers that will be poached from one tech company, say, you know, Facebook poaches someone from Google, and then LinkedIn poaches that person from Google, and it just goes around and around. And it's a very zero-sum equation because we're not putting new talent into the market at the rate that's needed. And so what ends up happening is that sometimes the least loyal employees are those that are rewarded for moving.
So the cost of acquiring students for short courses like those offered by General Assembly might be comparable to acquiring students for a degree course. In the long term, General Assembly may be looking at becoming a university itself, but maybe it offers nano masters, for example, rather than a full-blown master's course.
Likely not. We try and avoid the accreditation process, which all universities and colleges have to go through, predominantly because it slows us down in the way that we can change our curriculum.
Your courses are short, like 1 month, 6 months. How do you increase the lifetime value of each student?
Globally, roughly 94% of our immersive graduates, and so that means graduates that come from our three-month course, get a job in that discipline within 180 days. So we have a tremendous throughput of individuals, and we're very great at creating outcomes. We actually audit our outcomes every year, but the thinking is, well, you know, how can you learn to be a software or a junior software engineer in that short of time? We're teaching someone in a very short period of time, very intensely, how to solve problems and in a way how to learn. And it's all very project-based. And so someone's coming out of the course with a real can-do attitude because that you need that in order to be successful. It's that once they get on the job and they're making an impact, people continue to learn. But where it gets really interesting is when we look at our graduates 2 years or 3 years on, and they've continued to grow in that field, and they've taken on more senior positions. For the most part, for the people coming through our campus doors, once they're out and they're off, it's they're not coming back unless they're coming back to hire a graduate.
Which then brings me back to this point. The cost of acquiring that student did cost you some money. Then how do you sort of make them become repeat customers?
I think the broader idea is that we're trying to create a community around our graduates. So it's not about selling to them multiple times. It's about providing a pathway to the modern economy. So, you know, it's not that. Take Sydney, for example, or Singapore. The numbers are very similar in both of those campuses. Last year, we had roughly 50,000 people attend an event, a ticketed event, at both of those campuses. So 100,000 people across two campuses. Not a large percentage of those people ended up taking a three-month immersive course. Some of them took a three-month course. Some of them would have taken a 10-week evening course to upskill themselves. But the idea is not to sell to everyone. It's to create a thoughtful community of like-minded individuals around this idea of this modern digital economy.
Your critics say that courses by GA are lightweight compared to courses offered by universities or, you know, four-year colleges. So a few years ago, Google had said it would not hire graduates from boot camps, and they have found graduates from universities to be far more equipped. What's your response to such a criticism?
I don't know that that's criticism. I mean, if you're going to work for Google as a software engineer, you need to have a very very robust education, and they're looking for people that can solve problems that are that are quite sophisticated from day one. What we're doing is we're trying to democratize the access to a digital education or to roles in the modern economy. So we don't have, no one's coming out of a three-month program and going to work for Google. However, if you look at our graduates, after 2 years in the field or 3 years in the field, those are the people that then start to migrate towards your Googles and your Facebooks. So it's really just a question of, you have certain technology companies that are hoovering up all of the talent. And so that's making it difficult even for your IBMs or from some of your, professional services companies to access the right talent, because it's not, everyone wants to go work for Google. And there's no one size fits all. And I would point out that I believe Google has changed their hiring practices over the past 4 years. It used to be a very rigorous, and I'm sure it still is rigorous, but they had a very...
Perhaps a different standard. They don't necessarily need to hire someone from Carnegie Mellon all the time.
Well, because Uber, I think, went in and hired everyone from Carnegie Mellon's AI department. So there's a war for talent. And I think the companies, and this is probably a better way to frame it, but there's a war for talent. And the companies that that can weaponize education to put themselves on a better competitive footing, to make themselves more innovative, those are the companies that are going to win out in the modern economy. The other side of the equation of our business is working at scale with multinational companies and countries, for that matter. But currently, we're working with about 44 of the Fortune 100 to solve these talent issues at scale.
I look at your Python programming course, for example, which is like over 16 classes, 2 hours each.
Yes.
It takes far longer to learn Python as part of a four-year college degree. How would your course be different from what is taught at university level?
You know, I apologize, but I don't really know how universities teach Python. We have a very robust admissions program, so we only would accept people into that course that had some baseline understanding of programming so that they could be successful. And we split Python into sort of two tracks, Python for data science, and then Python for your more normal web applications. But you can learn things in a short period of time. It doesn't mean that you're going to come out of that 32-hour course ready to get a job as a Python developer. That's not the point of the course. The point of the shorter form, say 40 to 60-hour courses, is to take someone who has an interest in a field or an interest in a discipline or a language, and is likely already working in an adjacent job family, or using that or starting to use that on the job, and they want to accelerate their prospects within a current role.
Today on The Breakfast Grill, I'm speaking with Ryan Mayer, the Managing Director of Asia Pacific at General Assembly, the global education startup. After this, we'll discuss education trends in Asia and funding schemes.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
We're speaking with Ryan Mayer, the Managing Director, Asia Pacific at General Assembly. Are you noticing particular trends in Asia compared to, say, North America?
Specifically in this region, there are a lot of large family companies that have tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of employees. And these companies are run oftentimes like families. They're always looking out for their employees. They're very loath to go through layoffs, do the North American style, come in and slash and burn and fire, 20% of the workforce, which is a good thing. But this causes a unique set of challenges. It becomes then very important for companies like that to find ways to upskill their talent and reskill the talent that they have to fill the jobs that they need.
Training and education is a hugely competitive business, and including in Asia. How might General Assembly and the industry evolve in the next 5 to 10 years, in your view?
Oftentimes, I find the biggest competitor is doing nothing, and so for us, it's more about how do we set those motivations? How do we get people excited about learning Python, for example? How do we communicate the value proposition to show that? In a very clear manner that there are tens of thousands of roles just open. and oftentimes you have, depending on the geography, there are demographic shifts that are also affecting the work landscape. And it's also about bringing underrepresented groups into technology. This is the great thing about education of digital skills is that it really democratizes the process. Anyone can learn. Anyone can be successful. And because of the portability of these skills, you don't necessarily have to then, the end goal might not be to get a job 9 to 5 in a big company. It might be that you want to work 3 days a week as a contractor, and you can do that. You can plug yourself into the global economy in that way. I think if you look at your typical Silicon Valley engineering staff, it's overwhelmingly male.
But outside Silicon Valley, is that the same trend you're noticing, that there is still more men?
Absolutely.
And why is that so?
I have no idea. I have no idea.
I mean, I'm just wondering because if you're planning your strategy and your marketing narrative.
I don't know. I think it's, we're so focused on breaking down the barriers and increasing the number of women and underrepresented groups and encouraging people to take the courses that we're not really thinking about why it is, as it is. But I know that if you're building technology and you have too many of one kind of person, doing the engineering for that, doing the design for that, they're not going to ask the questions. They're not going to be equipped to have, to build technology that services a broader group of people.
Someone had this suggestion to me. If you wanted to encourage more girls to get interested in math, one solution might be to organize all girls' camps to teach math, because then they will feel more comfortable. They didn't feel like they had to try to adapt to a situation, try not to look so smart and so forth in front of the boys. I know it's a very curious idea, but I'm just wondering, even from your education experience prior to General Assembly, are there some nuances we could learn?
It's a very interesting question, and one that's that I find very very personal. I have two daughters, and how do I push them in a very STEM type pathway without being overbearing? I think what we do at General Assembly is we always support meetup groups that focus on women and underrepresented groups in technology. By creating a community, it's a very inclusive community. We want to highlight success stories. That then breaks down more barriers than anything else. It's about kind of highlighting the success stories and showing that and demystifying the pathway.
When we talk about education, it often comes down to who's going to pay for it. So what sort of training schemes would you develop with the Malaysian government?
This is very early days for us. I think one of the interesting things is that we're always thinking about innovative ways to break down the financing barriers. Sometimes that is with the government, and sometimes that's with the private sector. For example, in the United States, we launched last year a tremendously successful program called the Catalyst Program. It's an income share agreement. And effectively, we secured private funding such that anyone who passes through the admissions process for the Catalyst program, doesn't pay a dime for their immersive education. They only pay back a percentage of their income once they meet a certain threshold. So once they make over, say, X number of dollars per year, they pay back 10% of their income over a set period of time, and it's capped. So they never pay back more than, say, 1.5x of the course fees.
It sounds good on paper, but how do you track and monitor and enforce these agreements?
In the U.S., it's very the tax system is very simple to kind of pass along your tax data to the funding body. So, and it's also, you know, we're approaching it from a from a very positive standpoint. We think that, you know, by providing this opportunity, it's someone's not going to go through this and turn around and try and find a way to cheat us out of, cheat us out of that.
Perhaps that works in the US where the tax system is quite robust, but in emerging markets like Malaysia or even countries like Vietnam, I'm not sure if the tax system
absolutely
will support such
no,
things.
And even in Australia, where I spend most of my time, the tax system isn't set up for this kind of income share agreement. So in Australia, to sort of also create to break down the barriers to finance, we've created a study now pay later program where there's no interest involved, and a student effectively can study and then pays us back when they get a job. And we have great data, so we know that 94% of those students will have a job within 180 days, and that's sort of when things kick in.
What I understand, there are some schemes where the student goes through the course, and if they find a job, the government will pay you.
Exactly. It's I'll unpack that. So the Singapore government is through their IMDA group, they have or ministry, they have set up a funding source for any Singaporean citizen, and I think 15% of that funding source goes towards permanent residents. You know, we were sort of the pioneer in testing this out, but it's now open to a whole host. If they successfully graduate from the program, then the government pays a portion of their tuition. I think the funding scheme right now is for roughly 60 to 90% of the tuition fees. It's 90% if you're over 40. If you're under 40, it's 60% or 55%, depending on the course. And in Singapore, the outcomes rates are 96.7% of people being placed in jobs within 180 days.
In Singapore, it's possible there are many job opportunities for IR 4.0 type skills due to the nature of businesses there. Do you do your research before you come into a market like Malaysia to assess whether those kind of opportunities are available and they can absorb your graduates in 180 days?
Absolutely. And I think with, we've spoken with one company here, and I won't name it, but their needs alone will kind of look after the first year of a launch. So there's no shortage of jobs, it's a deficit that's not shrinking. So every year there are more and more people or more roles that are going unfilled that are needed.
In Malaysia, we have the HRDF, Human Resource Development Fund, but you can only access the funds if you are working with a company. So would you do the same here in Malaysia? Would you bring that scheme where individuals can just sign up and get this funding on their own?
We're in a lot of conversations now, and we're open to very creative arrangements. I don't think there's a one size fits all. So I don't want to, I don't want to hold up the Singapore example as the only example. We're also working with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to upskill a large swath of population there, and that looks completely different.
Well, given the Malaysian government is looking to cut costs, what would be a logical scheme for Malaysia?
You know, you need to look at it holistically. So yes, there's a cost to putting someone through this type of education, but then there's tax revenue. And if you look at the sort of the net present value of an individual who's starting off their career in a modern economy field, that person is going to be paying taxes, and highly employable for the next 5, 10, 15 years. So when you look at it in that way, I think there's a tremendous cost savings in putting money into individuals' education. But again, it's also, you have to be very thoughtful about how the ROI is created and tracking that and making sure that making sure that you're getting, for lack of a better phrase, bang for your buck in the education sense. Governments have really good intentions, but then everyone gets involved, and the end product or the end scheme isn't really as impactful as it could be.
So at this point, too early days to say what might work for the Malaysian government in terms of funding education?
It is early days. It is early days. We're partnering with MDEC, as you know, and they're being such a helpful partner in navigating this and thinking about these things very holistically and at a country level.
You mentioned you have two girls, and maybe in 10 to 15 years' time, would you encourage them to go to university?
Absolutely.
And why is that the case?
You know, that period of your life, say 18 to 22, there's a lot of growth that happens. And if that growth is happening in a sort of a nurturing learning environment where you're being taught critical thinking, where you're exploring history and I'm very much a traditionalist with that type of education. But if you're learning about these things, it's a really, it's a mind expanding time, and you're with other people that are also thoughtful and really engaged in the learning. So I think that has there's tremendous value in that. I just worry that they'll get into a university that it's really expensive. I think, on a personal note, I never saw my father happier than when my younger brother, we both went to the same university, when my younger brother graduated, and my dad knew that that was the last check he had to cut to the university. And it shouldn't be that difficult. It shouldn't be, you shouldn't have parents worried about how they're going to pay for their kids' education. So that's, that's a whole other conversation.
If one of your daughters decide, I'm going to be a data scientist, so instead of going to university, why wouldn't they just jump into a General Assembly course?
Well, first off, I'd get a genetic test, because I don't think that if my daughter said she wanted to be a data scientist, I would maybe question from where she came. I would be very supportive of that. I'd be very supportive of that. And I think that, but again, we're not trying to compete with universities. I think I would encourage them to do that in the summertime while also studying, going to university or doing that after the fact. General Assembly really sprung up as a way to take people, predominantly people that have already graduated or already started their work career, whether or not they had, formal university education, but to allow those people to have a pathway to the modern economy. And that didn't exist 8 years ago. And I think in many ways, it still doesn't exist. We're one of the only only education institutions that publishes and audits our annual outcomes data. So we're showing that there's a pathway to modern economy jobs. We're not going to get you a job at Google after 3 months of a course, but maybe after 2 years of working in the industry, that's not a crazy idea, and we've seen it happen.
Thank you so much for speaking with us, Ryan Mayer, Managing Director, Asia Pacific General Assembly. I'm Noel Lim on BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.